Hi, and welcome to episode 46 of Fresh Out of Tokens. This is Tanya, also known as Cipher of Tyr, and to my virtual right is David, if you want to say hello.
Hello.
We are very, very lucky to have this week as our guest, Zufi, formerly of Justice Points and now of Pop Culture Coven.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're so welcome. This is so exciting to finally have you on the other side of the mic.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've had the opportunity to interview you, I want to say, 3 times now. So it is, I think it's good that we finally turned the table.
Yes. And it'll be awesome because you are very cool to talk to, and you're awesome to hang out with in person as well.
Oh, well, thank you.
You are very, very welcome. And for those of you listening, you may notice that our intro spiel has changed a little bit. So for those of you listening, we are part of the Geek.fm network. Unfortunately, that site is down at the moment. So Chromatic Life is now on our Simplecast site. And for those of you wanting to rep I Need Diverse Games or Fresh Out of Tokens, we have items in our Spreadshirt shop, including mugs, t-shirts, tanks, etc. If you have questions, compliments, or other questions about the show, you can reach us at outoftokenscast.com or outoftokenscast.tumblr.com or email us at freshoutoftokens. We're also on Twitter at outoftokenscast, and both David and I have our Twitter in the show notes. And musical accompaniment is now provided by Mike Moody. You can hear more of her work at soundcloud.com/MikeMoody-1, which is also in the show notes. And without much further ado, let's get to our questions for Zufi. So I'm sure a lot of folks who probably listen to our show know who you are, but for those of you listening, tell us who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name is Zufi Allen. Right now I'm doing a podcast called Pop Culture Coven, which I know we'll talk about here in a bit. I also play a lot of games, do a lot of writing. I stream occasionally, not as much as I would like to. The whole 40-hour work week tends to get in the way of like a good streaming schedule, but I'd love to get back to that eventually because I think it's a lot of fun. But other than that, I used to be on a really fantastic podcast called Justice Points with Apple Cider Mage. We did 150 episodes talking about feminism and social justice perspectives in gaming, and then we ended up finishing the show at the end of 2015 to work on some new projects.
Very cool.
Yeah. The second question is basically always the same on this show, and that is, what got you into gaming?
Sure. I think for me, I kind of had two big introductions to gaming, and they came at like completely different points in my life. So when I was young, I remember playing a lot of Nintendo. I remember wanting the original Game Boy when it first came out, and I got one for Christmas, and it was like the best thing that happened to me. And then I kind of didn't play a whole lot of games after, you know, probably when I got to be a teenager or so. Like, at that point, it was really more just like playing Sega with my cousins when I visited them or something, but I wasn't really interested in doing it so much on my own. And then as an adult, I got back into gaming largely through originally playing World of Warcraft, which just sort of led me to a bunch of other things. But I have to say that kind of what got me interested in really more like mainstream AAA games that were not just MMOs was playing the Mass Effect series for the first time and really like getting invested in characters in a game in a way that was completely unfamiliar to me.
Huh, that's really interesting because like we're both BioWare fans, and it's interesting to hear what brings people to the series or like what effect it has had on people.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I've told my Dragon Age story many times, but it's just really cool to hear that from someone else as well. Well, beside gaming, obviously, you were on a very long running podcast and I had the honor of being a guest, but I was curious, for those that may not know your origin story, what got you into podcasting?
I saw Apple Cider Mage sort of looking for somebody who would be interested in doing a podcast about feminism in World of Warcraft. And she kind of tossed this out on Twitter one day, and like several weeks or maybe several months later, it dawned on me like that sounded like something I would love to do. So I reached out to her at that point. But it's hard for me to say exactly what it was that made me think podcasting would be fun. I mean, I think at its simplest level, it was probably just, I love having conversations with people about this kind of stuff. I really enjoy critical analysis. You know, I was a big geeky English lit major in college, so it's sort of a continuation of that without necessarily having to be in an academic like setting. So I feel like podcasting kind of gives me this opportunity to have really deep, interesting conversations with a huge variety of people, but in a really accessible way.
Oh, that's really cool, because, I mean, everyone knows how we got into doing this podcast totally on accident. but hey, it's worked out for 46 episodes.
That is true. I think this podcast was founded because we had a conversation one day, and that conversation turned into an episode of a podcast.
It's a great origin story. It's better than a villain origin story. We haven't turned villainous yet.
Yeah, our first guest was Chris Algu, right?
Yes, a Brooklyn Gamery.
And I think he might have been our first guest because you were literally talking to him at the time. Is that how that happened?
Yes, and we were going to do an interview, and he's like, well, is this going to be like podcast? How's it going to be? And I'm like, podcast, sure, let's do that. And here we are 46 episodes later, or 45 episodes later.
So, how are things going since Justice Points came to a close?
So I have been working mostly on my own new podcast now, Pop Culture Coven. But other than that, I've been kind of just enjoying being able to schedule things whenever I feel like it. You know, the thing about having the podcast was we were very consistent about, you know, every Saturday afternoon we recorded with our guests, and certainly that was a lot of fun and we had a lot of great conversations, but it is also nice to have that chunk of time back. And the nice thing about Pop Culture Coven is that since the episodes are relatively short, I can kind of work with my guests and just fit in those recordings at any point. Now, the editing is a little bit of a different story because there's a lot of editing that goes into them, but I really like the freedom that I have with this schedule that I've set up for the new podcast to just kind of fit things in wherever makes the most sense for me.
Cool. Yeah, because trying to do something every week can be a bit of a, well, it's a large commitment.
Right.
But, you know, we've always been pretty flexible, because sometimes we have guests that are not in the U.S., and it's a lot easier just to record on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It just means, you know, like, editing time may be shortened if it's for that same week. So you talked a little bit about Pop Culture Coven, but can you talk about, A, what made you kind of go back to podcasting? Because it wasn't very long between ending Justice Points and starting the new show. And then, you know, what exactly is Pop Culture Coven about?
Sure. So I actually recorded the first 6 episodes of Pop Culture Coven in the late summer of 2015. I didn't release those episodes until I think March, yeah, like March of this year, partially because I was kind of deciding what I wanted to do with the format and the editing. And then when we decided we were going to bring Justice Points to a close, I was like, I'll just hold off and do this, you know, once we're done. That way I can focus on one thing at a time. But what Pop Culture Coven is it's a 20-minute podcast where I have one guest on the show, and I record an interview with that guest and then go back and edit it so that we've got kind of like a 20-minute package of a little bit of analysis for me, a little bit of music and audio clips that are relevant to the topic we're discussing, and then a lot of the interview from the guests themselves. And every episode is about a single character, and that can be from, you know, TV, comics, movies, games, whatever, any type of media, but it's 20 minutes about a single character and talking to a single guest.
Okay. Have there been any particular episodes that you're like really excited for people to hear, or that you were just like chomping at the bit to talk about specific characters?
So I'm really happy with the whole first season. So what I'm doing is releasing 6 episodes over the course of 6 weeks, and then I take 6 weeks off to record and work on the next ones. But of the first season, I think I do really love them all, but I was very happy with the episode I did with Maddie Myers talking about Elizabeth Comstock from BioShock Infinite, because it was kind of one of the things that made me decide to do a show like that in the first place. Was Maddie had been on Justice Points at some point, and we were talking about Liz Comstock's character and kind of how much there is going on there and how much of it is unintentional versus intentional, and just a lot of the interesting things that come out of that. And at some point I thought about the fact that I'd really love to record this conversation, but what would I do with it? And that was when I started thinking about, you know, if I had a podcast of my own, what would I want to do? So definitely Maddie's episode, which was episode 6. I also really, really love the very first episode, which is Todd Harper talking about Loxana Troi from the Star Trek series, in part just because Todd has some really fantastic stories and just really heartfelt commentary about Loxana. So I love that episode too.
And Todd's really awesome. I just really, really enjoy all of his writing and commentary, and on, you know, especially about Bayonetta and a lot of things like queer issues and his academic work. And it's like, okay, I'm going to fangirl over Todd for a second. So hopefully when he hears this, he will have a big smile on his face.
He is also just the ideal podcast guest because he is so funny. He's got such a great sense of humor and timing. He will give you plenty of answer to any question that you want. So he is just always a joy to have on a podcast.
Okay, we need to get Todd on at some point then. Well, he is full of knowledge, and I enjoy chatting, and I don't get to chat with him as much as I'd like to.
It's true. Guests like that are always amazing. This week, or last week now, we put out a sort of slightly better version of an older episode, and one of the things I noticed is that anytime Catherine Cross started talking about something, I could, like, put it on the speaker and go do dishes for 3 minutes.
Okay.
Because she's just so elegant and well-spoken.
She is. I just want her and Austin to teach a class together.
Oh my gosh, that would be amazing.
No, her, Austin, and Todd.
Yes. Yeah.
I would, like, actually go back to school for that.
I've told this story many times, but I will tell it again. So Catherine and I sort of got reacquainted on Twitter when I saw some writing she was starting to do in the game sector, and then, like, she recognized my name and I recognized her Twitter handle because we actually were in a Warcraft guild together for, like, years. We healed together.
Oh my God.
Had no idea until we happened to find each other again on Twitter. So,
oh wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. She was a holy priest before it was cool. I'm sure she would want me to stress that.
Yeah. Of course, we're all BioWare fans in different ways. I mean, I feel like Tanya and I like different parts of what BioWare does.
We do.
So while you're here, we were going to ask, do you have any interesting, like, speculation about Mass Effect Andromeda that's coming up at time of recording?
Well, I don't have much because we have so little to go on. You know, I'm hoping at E3 maybe we get a little bit more information. But I would say my only, like, smart speculation that I kind of have is that it seems like how we're getting around the end of Mass Effect 3 and the fact that, like, you know, that galaxy is fundamentally changed depending on what decision your Shepard makes at the end of that series. It seems like they're sidestepping that question by taking us to a totally different galaxy, namely Andromeda. So I think that's probably a pretty straightforward, easy bet of a speculation. But other than that, I don't know. I mean, like, it looks like we're playing a human, and I'm sure there will be some aliens there. I'll be really interested to see if they just, like, abandon all of the alien races they used in the previous Mass Effect games because we're so far away from home, which I hope they don't, because there's so much more I still want to know about a lot of those species. But yeah, I really feel very much in the dark about Andromeda. I just feel like we have so little to go on right now.
Yeah, I've actually been avoiding the spoilers and well, supposed spoilers and leaks that have been out there because we did that dance with Dragon Age Inquisition, and I don't want to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we now have till 2017 to wait for the game, so...
Yeah, yeah. And this is my first experience with... So, like, I played Mass Effect. I played all three Mass Effect games after the series was done and over and had been for a while. Mm-hmm. And I played Inquisition for the first time when Trespasser came out and then went back and played the other two Dragon Age games. So I've never been in the position where I've had to be waiting for a BioWare game and deciding whether to deal with the spoilers or avoid them completely. So I'm still kind of, like, getting my feet wet with all this.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, at this point, it's so much speculation. Like you, I'm hoping we see something at E3, but until there's something official, I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, I know the game is coming out, that I'm content with that.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we've got our speculation out of the way, let's talk about what pie in the sky, absolute fan servicey thing that probably will never happen, but if you could have your way, mm-hmm. what would you want to see at Andromeda?
My silly answer is, like, Thane never died, but...
That's not a silly answer.
But I guess what I would love to see is something that's maybe a little bit more about sort of the vastness of space, but isn't necessarily just about, like, you know, going around and scanning every single planet for minerals, or like in Mass Effect 1, the sort of very repetitive, randomly generated worlds. I'd really like a feeling of, even if we only are on, you know, a couple of planets, I'd love a sense of, like, exploration of, you know, like, nobody has ever been here before. Maybe there aren't any sentient species here, like, it's just a very alien and kind of not familiar and maybe sort of, like, hostile world. Maybe even a little, like, horror sci-fi. I would definitely be up for that. It's not very fan servicey, though, I guess.
Hey, it is what it is. David, I forget, you're not really into the Mass Effect series, are you?
No, I mean, I know when they announced Andromeda, I got no limit of joy from Voyager jokes. Okay. About how it's Mass Effect Voyager.
Oh, God.
Which, as a premise, is actually something I'm very okay with for reasons that she just discussed. It's basically the thing she described.
Okay.
New weird stuff, and you could still explore the species and so on that you already have because they could have come with you.
Right.
Like, true. You could still have your Belena Torres and your Garrus.
Oh my gosh, yeah, like, let's cherry pick the best people from Voyager and the best people from the Mass Effect universe and put them all on a ship. I'm so here for that.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
Tom Paris does not get to come.
Oh my God. Wow.
I'm sorry. Like, it's just, you gotta draw a line in the sand sometimes. So.
Well then. Sorry, Tom. You are left behind.
I did really like Harry Kim.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
I did.
The Doctor obviously gets to come.
Yeah. What about Janeway, though?
It depends on who's writing her.
Okay.
All right. I like that answer. Yeah.
It's kind of how Voyager went.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot about Star Trek that doesn't make sense. In some cases, some episodes are great.
Yeah.
Some episodes, well, I don't know what to say about that. Which is ironic, sure. Because I'm talking at a pop culture event about Star Trek this weekend.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So it'll be very interesting. I get to talk about the mirror episodes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Some of my favorite episodes of Enterprise, but that's not, like, a really high bar, so.
Yeah, those were the two best episodes. Enterprise came around. I felt like it was getting better toward
the
end.
The last season is pretty great when they realize they just want to, like, camp it up and do a whole bunch of, like, callbacks to the original series. That's fine.
I feel like the next question is what we've been talking about for the last 10 minutes.
Possibly, but it's BioWare IPs, not outside of BioWare IPs.
Oh, okay.
So if you could, I suppose, make any BioWare game with a mix of characters from the IPs, what would that be? And, like, where would you set it, I guess?
Oh my gosh, this is so good. And, like, I don't know. I would want to do something, I love detective stories. If I could get sort of noir mystery and, like, have, oh, who would be great for that? Let's see. There's pretty much nobody. Everyone from Mass Effect I would love to bring along. Like, Garrus is obviously still, like, your good-natured buddy cop partner. Like, he's the easiest to cast. But I feel like I could just throw everybody into that universe, and I don't know that there's anybody I would want to leave behind.
I would leave Ashley.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, we can leave Ashley. And I'm not really a Caden fan either, so we can leave him, too.
Oh, my God, can we? Can we just have Vermeier and leave both of them?
I know, right? Can we save that one Salarian guy instead?
I know. Because that breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm.
Shepard, where are you going? I'm going to save generic Team 3 instead of the Salarian commandos.
Yeah, but I'd love to do something like that, just a completely different setting, you know, than either sci-fi or fantasy. And it's funny, David, even though I came to BioWare through Mass Effect, because I am generally much more of a sci-fi person than I am fantasy, Dragon Age has ended up being the series that I think I'm more invested in, because I really love how deep the lore is. And for as much as I love Mass Effect and as much as I think there's a lot of potential there, the lore is just not as deep. And, like, I love that I can sit there with Dragon Age stuff and just speculate until, you know, we've got 20 installments of the game or something. So that's the only other thing I would say, too, about, like, my ideal setting for a BioWare game. I would love to, after we know the answers to a lot of the questions that we still have in the Dragon Age universe, maybe get to actually play a game where we got to experience some of those historical things, like, you know, Andross Day, or like when Tevinter is first founded.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
The sort of morality play you'd end up with if all of your characters were, like, followers of Andraste is exactly the sort of stuff BioWare writes.
It's so true. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You would have the one guy that's all about it and the other guy that's like, I don't know, I think this is just nonsense we're doing.
Yeah, which is pretty much, you know, somebody's like, well, I don't really believe it, but I sort of believe it, which is convenient. So I really would like to have characters, and I'm sure this will never ever happen, but, you know, have characters that have different theological perspectives, mm-hmm. or beliefs, actually have conversations, not just basically go, mages suck, Templars are evil, and thus we have the Mage-Templar War.
I feel like you get hints of that in Inquisition with some of the party banters, especially with Cassandra, because she has kind of such an arc of being very set in her beliefs at the start of the game and then really kind of questioning more and more as it goes on. Mm-hmm. But I would agree with you completely that sort of your major political players are all, like, very much pretty one-dimensional.
They are, and you know, it's hard because, you know, like, I feel like Cullen could have been deeper,
mm-hmm.
with, you know, his crisis of faith, the lyrium addiction, but addiction is also something that needs to be handled very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you've got basically this Catholic Church in the game world that hooks its soldiers on drugs to make them compliant. And then you also take away the rights of a whole other class of people because they happen to have supernatural abilities. Or meta, like, I don't know what it would be.
Let's talk about that shit, because it's messed up. <You know? laughs>
Well, it is, because, you know, like, you're persecuting the people who could do a lot for humanity, but mm-hmm. you keep them locked up, you take away their rights, and go, but you're dangerous because you might set something on fire.
And you force them to undergo a possession to prove that they're capable of warding off possession. Whereas, like, you know, they talk about the frequency of possession with mages in the Dragon Age universe, and it's like, okay, but how could we, those are not reliable statistics, you know, like, we don't know how many mages are really apt to be possessed if left to their own devices. Like, how common is it for, you know, like, apostate mages or Dalish mages who don't have to undergo the harrowing? This is the stuff I want to know.
That's really interesting. I think part of the problem is that you view this series as a main character, so mm-hmm. it's sort of like everyone's getting possessed all the time without the mages knowing about
right.
But that may just be that interesting stuff happens to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always hard to gauge, like, how a fictional world would actually behave when you have to consider that you're the most interesting story you could be right now.
Yes, yes.
True, and then, you know, the first Dragon Age is very much the hero slash heroine's journey. You're kind of chosen, but you don't really want to be chosen, and it goes on with Hawk, who's really reluctant, depending on how you're playing it. Like, well, I was just trying to run from the Blight. I wasn't trying to save everybody.
Right.
I love Dragon Age 2. I think that's part of the reason why I like Dragon Age better, is that mm-hmm. it's very much a great standalone story.
It is.
Mass Effect has to be a trilogy to really work.
Well, and I think that's what's so compelling about Dragon Age as a series, is that because they've been willing to do this, like, slightly radical thing and say, hey, no, we're going to have a different protagonist every game, that allows them to say, okay, well, this next game is set 10 years in the future from the last one, or this game runs, like, concurrently with the game that you just played, and then we'll do a little more past that. Like, that's not something you get to do if you're playing as, you know, Shepard for 3 games, or, you know, any major AAA series that carries a protagonist over the course of several games. So I'm thrilled that they made that choice, because, like, I'm sure as writers, it's got to be much more interesting to be able to explore all these different perspectives and all these different time periods. And as a player, I love being able to get that much of the lore rather than, like, okay, well, this guy's, you know, premier action star years are over this, like, span of 2 or 3 decades, so we can't really take it any further than that.
There are always these lore things that under the surface that kind of bug me. And, you know, I'm that nerd that overthinks the game as I play it. And I'll talk about this more when we get into what we've been playing, but I actually was able to recreate Fenris and Inquisition.
I'm so excited for you, by the way.
Well, it was just because, you know, there's been a lot of fic out there with, like, what if Anders becomes Inquisitor? And apparently there's what if Carver, Hawk's brother, becomes Inquisitor, which never in a million years would have occurred to me. Apparently it's a thing in fic.
I see a lot of people who headcanon their warden becoming Inquisitor, which is like, I don't get how you reconcile that, but whatever, that's fine.
Well, and the warden would be near their calling at that point, so how would they even be Inquisitor?
I mean, they told us the warden isn't even in Thedas at this point, so I don't know.
Fan fiction and retconning is a beautiful
right.
thing.
Yeah, I mean, I can't fault people.
Yeah, I'm just going to try to move along.
It's okay.
It's all right. We'll probably end up here again. we usually ask, what's coming up? What do you have planned in the near future?
So I'm on my 6 weeks off right now from putting out new episodes of Pop Culture Coven, but the first new episode of the second season is going to start on May 24th. So in the meantime, I'm still recording a couple of episodes. Tanya actually got to do one not that long ago that's going to be out in the second season, so definitely check that one out. I bet no one can guess which character it's about. So. And other than that, I have been working a whole lot and writing a whole lot of fan fiction, believe it or not. So.
Woot, fanfic.
Yep.
So normally we would go to listener questions, but there's actually been some really good articles out in the last week or so. So I wanted to bring back our old tradition of having articles to discuss, because they both deal with AI. And speaking of Catherine Cross, one of the articles is by her and the other is by Lori Penny. And one article, the article by Catherine, is about when robots are an instrument of male desire, because AIs are usually depicted as female, given feminine attributes of female voice, Siri, Cortana, things like that. So I wanted to kind of delve into both these articles a little bit before we jump into our listener questions. So, Zufi, as our guest, did you have any particular thoughts or anything you wanted to kind of dig into in Catherine's piece?
So I loved both of these articles, and it actually, okay, I'm really trying not to steer things back to Mass Effect, I'm sorry, but...
I had the same thought, so go for it.
I just wanted to point out that, you know, one of my favorite sci-fi themes is always going to be, like, the exploration of artificial intelligence and the way that we ethically accept that, how we treat AIs, what treatment AIs deserve. I love all those kind of questions. And so to the extent that those are questions we kind of need to start asking, especially when we talk about something like Tay AI and not so much about like what do we ethically owe to Tay, the AI, but what do we ethically owe to the people who are going to be affected by the things that she says? These are questions that I love to see people talking about because it does seem like it's both kind of a really good thing that we need to be talking about because it sort of makes us conceptualize what we ethically owe to each other as, you know, like fellow human beings and what are our limits of that definition and should we expand that definition? So yeah, I love all this stuff.
One of the things that Catherine says in her article is that, you know, going back to what you're saying about caring and the repercussions, and this is quoting verbatim from the article, is that there are a few reasons why you should care about this. First and foremost, the way we treat virtual women tells us much about how actual women are allowed to be treated and what desires shape that treatment. Secondly, as we inch closer and closer to true AI, we are seeing ever more clearly what this next phase of capitalism will look like, helping us to understand the expectations placed on human laborers in the here and now. And she also goes on to quote Lee Alexander's article about the Tay debacle. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people can't, you know, I don't know if respect is the right word in this situation, but look at how quickly they turned what was an experiment into something terrible. It took, less than a day, less than 12 hours.
Yeah.
Granted, the AI did learn, which was the point of the experiment, but look at what lessons it took away. And then it made me circle back to, and people wonder why there's always a fear that AI will kill us.
Yeah, we'll teach it to really quickly.
You know, if they've already taught Tay to, like, be a Hitler-loving sex bot that is saying filthy, vulgar things on the internet in less than 12 hours, what do they think is going to happen if there was an AI that, let's say, had access to nuclear codes?
Right.
Or, you know, could shut off the water to major cities or electricity. For me, this was an experiment that kind of proved why we have that fear of AIs, because look at how we treat them.
Yeah. But it's also so naive, you know, and I know everyone kind of talked about this at the time when Tay AI was, you know, wreaking havoc on Twitter, but it's so naive from a development or a programming standpoint to not realize that that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like that's just the logical conclusion if you know anything about Twitter, you know, like, yeah, of course that happened. So why, before you released an experiment like this, didn't you, you know, account for some of that, have some safeguards in place? Like, here are some words Tay can't say.
Yeah. I mean, well, as we've seen, a lot of people who are in charge of Twitter don't know what Twitter actually does and don't use the service themselves, which is really shameful and would explain so much about the abuse on Twitter.
I mean, they know what Twitter does. It sends them a check. That's what Twitter does, right?
Touche. Did you have thoughts about Catherine's article before we move over to Lori Penny's piece?
Yeah, she mentions cockpit warnings at one point, and one of the things I've always sort of found interesting is that one of the reasons that cockpit warnings have a feminine voice is because the way pilots respond to it, it is closer to if you had read something than someone telling you something.
So basically they can strip agency from not even a real woman and make it easier to respond to. I would think a cockpit warning voice. I know, it just seems odd that would be the reason, but then again, it shouldn't be odd to me considering how people treat women, both virtual and real.
Well, I mean, the reason they wrote down is just that pilots respond better to it. So,
right. So I wonder if it's like this assumption that a female voice is more calming, more soothing, you know, like something along those lines.
There's, it always seems like they did tests and things, but it always, we always sort of like to give the government more credit than it actually does. The actual reason is pilots seem to have just handled that better. They don't know exactly why, but, you know, we can make inferences.
Interesting. The other article we were going to look at is in the same topic area, which is Lori Penny's Why Do We Give Robots Female Names? Because We Don't Want to Consider Their Feelings. And it kind of dovetails into Catherine's article. Well, they complement each other very well. So, Zufi, of course, as our guest, feel free to jump in on this one.
Well, I liked one of the things I thought was really interesting in Lori Penny's article was talking specifically about like sexual agency when it comes to robots and particularly female robots. And one of the pieces of media that she mentions is Ex Machina, which I know everybody's got like a variety of feelings on. Personally, I loved that movie. I thought it was really, really compelling. But this sort of question, again, of like, what are the boundaries there? At what point do we think that assault of a robot body is equal to assault of, you know, of a physical human body as we think of it currently? And, you know, is that a crime? What does consent look like for robots or AIs? I mean, again, I think these are all like really compelling questions that we're going to need to confront sooner rather than later.
It's interesting because both articles, you know, of course, because I'm a BioWare nerd, made me think about Edie, or EDI, when you meet her in Mass Effect 1 and 2, she's still very much part of the ship. And then she is given a hypersexualized feminine body in Mass Effect 3. And, you know, I don't know how you feel about Joker and Edie, but I just always felt something was not right about Joker's obsession with her because it seemed very, I'm trying to think of the right word, because as we know, bad wording will come back to bite me in the ass later. But the way that he responds to Edie and treats her, it's like he's treating her both as a thing and as an object of desire. When he physically probably could not consummate that desire because she is still a machine.
So I think Edie and Joker is sort of a potential minefield for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. First of all, as intelligent as Edie is depicted as being in both 2 and 3, she's also shown as like very naive. Mm-hmm. Specifically about, you know, human relationships and sexuality. She asks a lot of questions about that, and they're mostly played off as jokes, and, like, you know, I get that. But it also sets up a dynamic of, like, oh, this naive robot who needs someone to, like, teach her about these things, which I think is pretty unsettling. But on the other side, and you can argue this both ways, because obviously Edie is not a real character who actually gets to make her own decisions. She is written by people who make those decisions for her. But what I think is interesting about the body that Edie ends up with eventually is that she finds that body for herself, basically. She knows where that body is. She kind of like tricks you into going there to get that body for her. And then she puts her AI consciousness into it. So again, I can't read that as, like, a full empowerment story in any way because, like, again, Evie's not a real person, so mm-hmm. she didn't get to make that choice. But I think it is interesting to look at the story from that direction and ask, like, okay, so what does that mean, though? If Edie is this consciousness that has no physical form and she gets to make her own physical form for herself, and what does that look like?
I never really thought about Edie getting a physical body as really any kind of empowerment at all, because she seems like she's going through puberty almost during Mass
right.
Effect 3, and, you know, asking Shepard the awkward questions like a big sister, like a little sister would ask a big sister, and, you know, subsequent DLCs with Joker and Edie where it's clear that they're kind of together, it always left me with this very uncomfortable reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Because she just, like you said, she seemed naive And it just seemed like Joker was being, like, the quote-unquote nice guy and kind of skeevy by always wanting to be with her. But then he tells someone, oh, yeah, she's my robot assistant because of his medical condition. And it's like, well, I don't know. This just seems weird. But that's me. It's probably, again, overthinking Mass Effect like I do.
It had another AI in it originally, I think. And there's this kind of part of that process is getting rid of that AI, which I want to say, oh gosh, and it's been so long since I played that quest line, but I feel like the other AI, you know, you justify like destroying this consciousness because it's kind of evil or like maybe working for Cerberus or something like that. But I know the body had a previous occupant.
Right. It was a Cerberus doctor or something that you're chasing.
Yeah.
And you capture her and it's like while she's still on the ship, she removes that AI or deactivates it. And, you know, of her own free will, supposedly, she searches out this body so she can have a physical form. And then you're like, oh, well, I guess you're part of the squad now and no longer part of the ship, even though she exists in the ship and physically.
Yeah.
Like our guest, I always sort of got the vibe that the ship wanted to have a body to walk around in. But I don't remember, like, where the body came from. That could still be the sexualization of that form could just still be imposed on her because that was the body she could get to.
True, because the body does look different when the Cerberus scientist is running around in it. So she basically is naked, for lack of a better word, because the way that body is changed when she takes it over is pretty much like, you know, she has camel toe. She has robotic camel toe.
Robotic camel toe.
She does. But, you know, thinking about AI in the actual article, her points about, you know, AIs being given feminine names and feminine anthropomorphication, if that's the right way to say that. I struggle with that word. It makes me wonder if AIs and robots and things like that were given masculine traits and names, would we even be having this conversation? Or would it be like your robo bro would come over and like play games with you? Oh, come on. Like, nobody would think to call a robotic dude a robo bro.
No, it's perfect.
No, I'm just imagining a robot being like, high five, and you being like, sure, and then you remember he's made of metal.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be bad.
Or, I mean, I think it's also an interesting question. Do AIs have to have a body for us to think of them as consciousnesses that are worthy of ethical treatment?
Mm. True. Very true.
You would think an AI's experience would be weirder than that, rather than having a body or being a ship, that she would just be both of those things and learn about stuff she did whenever she's around herself.
That is a fair point.
Yeah, there are possibilities of existence and perception that is just so alien to the human experience. I'm not sure how we would.
Huh.
I mean, yeah, like, think about being a ship. You know, that's so far out of anything that we would be able to relate to. And I wish that was... they do a little bit with it, with Edie, but I wish they had explored that a little bit more, just, like, the weirdness of that situation for her. And for, you know, I think, unfortunately, they focus so much about, like, how weird it is for Edie to be human, but, like, that's just because we can laugh about that, because we know what it's like to be human, so it's funny to see somebody else try to learn that. But I would have much preferred, like, how weird it is for us to have to wrap our heads around what it was like for Edie to be the ship. You know, that's the more interesting perspective to me.
True. And to kind of coexist in two places at once.
Yeah.
Cause you know, I have a hard enough time splitting my attention between two things. I can't imagine doing it all the time. And, you know, walking a body around while she's still keeping, the ship going and helping Joker with it. So it's very interesting, and that is something I would like to explore more.
I do imagine it would be slightly easier if you had two brains to work with.
Right.
You know, the ship still has computers.
True. I'm just thinking of, like, the neural processing it would take to walk around and that the body that she has, and, you know, fight and everything else, and not let the ship crash.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it's one of those things where I'm like, huh. See, now I want to go find a fic that might have that.
Ooh. There, see, the answer is always somewhere in fan fiction.
It is. So that will be my mission once we're done recording. See if there's a good fic out there. Cause there's some.
Well, please send me your recommendation.
I shall. Because as we know, fan fiction can be the Wild West. Or you can find occasional nuggets of gold. Did either of you have any more thoughts on Lori's article or Catherine's article before we shift over to listener questions?
There is one thing that occurred to me. Is that when we build robots in the present tense, we live in a world where we build robots now, by the way. That's always weird.
Uh-huh.
There are, you hear about, like, in the news, there's, like, the ScarJo bot that the dude built. They're either women, but some of the time, when they're not women, you hear about, say, Boston Dynamics. You know, that video of the guy pushing the robot with a broom. They're dogs. They're either supposed to like behave like women or pets.
Well, because I think part of that is if someone made a robot and gave it a male persona, even made it look physically, you know, male for all intents and purposes, would other men be friendly to it or see it as a threat? Because in Lori's article, she talks about, like, how there's very lifelike sex bots. You know, not for nothing, I'm sure there's a market for male sex bots. You know, if not from hetero or bi women, then from bi or gay men. But yet, all the sex bots are, you know, women, or their mouths look like existing porn stars or something. And it's part of the commodification of women, I think. Men would never be commodified that way. Well, technically there are bots, but I'm not sure under what definition of robot they would fall. And so this is a rated E for explicit podcast. So for anyone that is disturbed by explicit discussion of robot sex, please skip ahead for a couple minutes. You know, there are things called fucking machines. And, you know, they are, for all intents and purposes, robots that usually have, you know, vibrator or dildo appendages. So would those be what we would consider male sex bots?
No, I would say, because they're not AIs. I think you need to make a distinction between a machine, mm-hmm. you know, that functions given a specific set of parameters, and an AI that's able to sort of have a degree of free will, or to rationalize, or to, you know, make choices.
Okay.
Fortunately, for the most part, our AIs aren't in robots. Although I do think those, like, Boston Dynamic dog bots have to have some complicated processes going on.
Right, right. But that's about sort of, I mean, and I don't want to, like, split hairs too far on this, but I think with those, the sort of complicated processes that are going on are about movement. And obviously that's extremely impressive and important as well, but it's not quite the same thing as learning language and adapting language and then becoming terrible on Twitter, you know?
True. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I actually, they're developing basically with like Boston Dynamics was developing, which I think in the terms of consciousness, you would have to phrase as like instinct. It's how you know how to move your hands. It's just a thing it's the way your brain is designed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
While they have, you know, like Tay is trying to simulate social interaction badly, or very good. I don't know. I don't know how pessimistic I feel today.
Well, I'll be pessimistic for you. As Lori said in her article, they basically gave Twitter a baby to raise and see what happened. Which is a terrible, terrible idea. Don't give Twitter a baby to raise.
She never got the sort of social filters that you tend to get at some point, and sort of, or any level of, like, being able to differentiate between, like, what is a harmful thing to say and what is not a harmful thing to say.
Yeah.
True.
And we are just naturally wired for that. Babies are ridiculous at discerning emotion.
Okay, to kind of shift away from from our lengthy discussion of AI, which is awesome. These are the kind of discussions I like having because I'm a big nerd. But we do have a couple listener questions, and then we usually wrap up with what we've all been playing and or reading this week. So Tim, as always, has come through with some questions for you, Zufi.
Okay.
So his first question, and we touched on a little bit when we talked about Andromeda Pie in the Sky ideas, but if you could bring one crew member along into Andromeda, who would it be?
So I know my answer then was, my Thane that had never died, but my real answer is Tali. I love Tali so much. Tali needs to be in all of my Mass Effect games.
Okay.
Tim also asks, Warden, Hawk, or Inquisitor, and which companion from any game to accompany them?
Okay, I hate this question a lot. All right, so as brief as I can, I love Warden, Hawk, and Inquisitor for three entirely separate reasons. Inquisitor is like the blank slate self-insert. If that's what you're going for, this is the one you play. Warden is like so snarky, a million different possibilities for how to answer every question, but for me, always a little spoiled by not having voice acting on the lines that you choose, which I get because there's a ton of them, whatever. But I think between the three, I got to pick Hawk because, especially playing as a Purple Hawk, which I always do, I just love the sense of personality. I love all of the stuff that comes out of Hawk's mouth because it is ridiculous and just funny and great, and I love how much of a reluctant hero Hawk is. So definitely Hawk between those three. And which companion from any game to accompany them? Oh my gosh, this is such a nightmare. I guess I don't know. I like Liliana a lot, but is it her? Meryl. I guess Meryl.
Really? You sound reluctant.
Because I love so many of them for, like, different reasons. But, like, if I just need one person to be my best friend for, like, you know, and that's my only choice, then I'm bringing Meryl.
Okay. That leaves a third question, which is a little weird for me to say because it's about me. But Tim asked, if you were to invite Cypher to your Pop Culture Coven, who would you talk about?
So, Tanya, who did you talk about when you came on Pop Culture Coven?
This should be no shock to anyone. But I had to get my Fenris feels out. I have many, many Fenris feels in case anyone is unsurprised at this answer.
So that'll be out either end of May or in June once I get the schedule locked in. But you will get to hear Tanya talk about all of her Fenris feels. Well, not all of them, I'm sure, but, you know, at least 20 minutes worth.
There's hours worth of Fenris feels.
I'm sure.
And so we're finally at our last section where we talk about what we're playing. So as our esteemed guest, you get to go first.
So Overwatch, the new competitive shooter that Blizzard's been doing, is now in, I think, open beta. It was in, like, limited beta for the last couple days. So I've been playing a lot of that with friends and having a lot of fun just trying to get better at it. One of the problems I've run into was I wasn't in the full closed beta, but I was in both of the, like, big push beta weekends. Mm-hmm. And in each of those weekends, I think there were two or three maps that you could do, and there's way more than that in the game. So now that all of the maps are available, I'm just, like, zoning into these cities. I'm like, okay, nothing about this is familiar. I don't know where anything is. I'm going to get lost 15 times. I'm going to run into a corner and somebody's going to shoot me, you know? But I've been having a lot of fun with it. I love the art style in Overwatch. I love a lot of the characters. The play is very, very fun. So I've been having a good time with that.
Awesome. I have been playing Fragments of Him, which is a new game from Sassybot Studios and Mata Haggis. It is actually about grieving and loss and death. Now, I only played a little bit. I streamed about a half hour of it on release day on Tuesday. And it's the story of Will, who dies suddenly. He is one half of a gay couple as well. And so there's a lot of reflecting back on his life and also kind of through flashbacks of people who knew him and are left behind. So if grieving is something that is difficult for you, or death, or talk of death, it's difficult. The game may be triggering for you, but the art style is fantastic. It is very visual novel-y. It is not, you know, high action. There is a lot of dialogue, and a lot of talking, a lot of processing, kind of who Will was, and you get to learn who he was, and then the people who are dealing with the loss of him. And it's emotionally, so far, very resonant. And I'll probably stream the rest of it early next week. And I expect it to be pretty much a gut punch. Thanks to the power of modding, I have started yet another playthrough of Inquisition, but this time with Fenris as the Inquisitor. So we shall see how that goes. And what have you been playing, David?
Speaking of modding, downloaded Morrowind in Steam, reinstalled the construction kit. There's actually something like beautiful about the Morrowind construction kit, because they didn't have voice acting yet, so it's all just mechanics. If you're good at scripting or if you're good at writing, you can create something. And the bar to entry is a little bit higher today because you also have to have 14 friends now to do voices.
Okay, so people actually do fully voiced mods?
For like Oblivion and Skyrim and Fallout, yeah. Wow. People have.
That's pretty deep. Like, I could barely mod anything in Dragon Age Origins. I'm not even trying in Inquisition.
Yeah, in Fallout New Vegas, there are like two or three different mods that add a companion who is fully voiced and has opinions about things.
Okay.
It's kind of ridiculous. But
that's kind of cool.
Yeah, but that involves time and equipment that you really didn't need back in the day of Morrowind. I feel like more people should play with Morrowind because it's just a perfect place to start looking at, like, the way a Bethesda game works, because you can really focus on the scripting rather than the social engineering of having enough people.
Cool. But speaking of which, sadly we are at time, and I will be a sad panda because we must let Zufi go back to the real world and not about Dragon Age and Mass Effect feels with us. But Zufi, where can folks find you online?
You can find me mostly on Twitter. I'm at SOE Zufi. That's SOETZUFIT. And you can find my podcast, Pop Culture Coven, at popculturecoven.simplecast.fm.
Awesome. And you are on Patreon as well, correct?
I am. I am on Patreon, and it's just Patreon/SOE Zufi.
Awesome. And we will make sure that there is a link to your Patreon in the show notes.
Thank you.
You are very welcome. David, where can people find you?
I can be found probably most easily on Twitter at Red Conversation. You can also find me at davidlreeves.com, which has a contact form where you can contact me. But if it's not working, you can email me at work@davidlreeves.com. And you should do that if you need an editor or anyone who has the skills to run a magazine for 2 years. That's a thing I did.
And as for me, I'm CypherTyr basically everywhere. So CypherOftyr, and that is across Twitter, Tumblr, my website, Patreon, and Twitch. So yeah, that is the end of episode 46. Thank you again, Zufi, for hanging out with us. This has been awesome. I'm so happy this happened.
Oh, anytime. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. So you'll come to regret that later. All right. And dear listeners, we are done for this week. And when we come back, we will have Donna Pryor with us to talk about OrcaCon and the plans for 2017 and her guest of honor and other things she's trying to do to make the tabletop space better. So see you in a week. Bye.